Hey friends, I hope you're well. Jumping in here to make a little announcement. My book is out. It was co-authored with John Perkins. Many of you probably know who he is, a pastor, civil rights leader. He has an amazing story. If you haven't, go out and grab his books. I had the supreme honor of co-writing this book with him. It's called Go and Do, and you can check it out now. You can get it on Amazon or wherever books are sold, but I will tell you that you can get it for 40% off if you go to my website and go to the tab that says discount code. So if you go to shaneblackshear.com/discount-code, it will take you to a place where you can put your email in, sign up, and you will automatically get an email with a coupon code for 40% off. And I would be honored if you would read it. Okay. Here's the show.
Hi, I'm Deb.
This is Frankie V.
I'm Grant.
Hi, this is Phil.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Steven.
Hi, I'm Jim.
Hi, I'm Matt.
We're Tim and Terry.
I'm Susan.
Hi, this is Phil.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Just visit supportseminarydropout.com.
Just go to supportseminarydropout.com.
And I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Let's go. With me today, I have Vince Bontu. Vince, welcome to Seminary Dropout. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, Vince?
Yeah. It's great to be here. And my name is Vince Bontu, and I teach church history and Black church studies at Fuller Seminary, and I also run the Meacham School of Hymenote, which is a biblical Afrocentric seminary program built on kind of purpose at building up leaders in the Black church and community. And then I also pastor Beloved Community Church with my wife in St. Louis, Missouri, where we live with our two daughters.
Very cool. Now, is that Meacham School, is that a part of Fuller? Is that something totally different? How does that work?
Oh, yeah. No, it's a independent seminary, school of theology. Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Well, we're here today to talk about your newest book, A Multitude of All Peoples, Engaging Ancient Christianity's Global Identity. Vince, I wonder if for you, how much of this book was from you being an academic and wanting to explore something that hadn't been fully explained in one place? And how much of this was a pastoral response to people increasingly believing that Christianity is a white man's religion?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I would say it was really both. And it was something that I would say kind of the first part of that kind of flowed out of the second. Because for me, just my being a scholar in early African Christianity and reading early Coptic and Syriac and Ethiopic texts getting my graduate studies and now like teaching and publishing and kind of researching primarily in that area, that whole kind of, vocation basically of mine came out of a very pastoral and missional and apologetic and evangelistic kind of heart for precisely what you said, that I've always had a strong sensitivity to people, especially people of color, feeling at home or feeling like they have a place in the Christian tradition, and also this perception that people have of Christianity being a Western or a American or a white man's religion, and however people word it, this idea that people have of their people not fitting in the Christian tradition, that's always been a big passion of mine and many others as well, especially people in areas of missiology and evangelism and cross-cultural ministry. But one thing I noticed was that people in that field, kind of in missions and cross-cultural theology and contextualization and global Christianity, who also share similar values and heart that I do, they often focus on kind of the spread of Christianity in more modern times, like in the last few centuries. And so there's, there's a lot of good stuff to uncover there. But a lot of times what can even happen, and I even point this out in the beginning of the book, a lot of times what can happen is that when we only study how Christianity has spread among non-Western people, but when it has come through Western intervention, is it can actually exacerbate this idea that Christianity came from the West to the rest. Even though now it's becoming global and you know, in new ways, we can sometimes think that that means that Christianity became global, period, that happened in the modern period. So that's kind of the reason why I'm particularly interested in understanding the earliest kind of periods to show how Christianity came straight from, you know, the region of Palestine and directly into Africa and Asia and other places without Western intervention. So to show that Christianity isn't becoming global, but it's always been global.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that you emphasized from the beginning, which I appreciated. I mean, I think there are some people who are actually under the belief that the only way that that Black folks got the gospel was through slavery, through you know, coming to America and finding their slaveholders having this religion. And like you say, it's way older than that. What, you know, Christianity in Africa was way before the Atlantic slave trade in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right.
So you, in the book, you are extremely thorough and extremely detailed. And I was fascinated by how in the first section, I had never realized that Christianity and its proliferation in Rome was seen as a Western phenomenon. In other words, you know, I think of ancient Rome as, well, this is where, you know, Jesus and Jews in his day, they were under occupation from Rome. But Jesus is, you know, they're in the ancient Near East, right? And so I wonder if you could break down, you know, how is Rome considered the West at this point?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I would say I don't know if you know, I don't know if we could say that, like, you know, Rome was considered the West in the way that we think of that term today, or like talked about for the last like 1,000 years. I mean, it was in the sense of being the Western half of the Roman Empire, which the Eastern half was in Constantinople. But all of that was one empire. And exactly as you said, that empire, the irony is that that empire was very antagonistic towards Christianity, more so than even other places that Christianity was at. Like, as we mentioned, Christianity has always been global. So it wasn't like it, you know, it originally came up in the Roman Empire only, because the people group that Christianity first emerged with, the Hebrews, as you said, they were an occupied people, a colonized people, but also they, the Aramaic speaking people were kind of at the crossroads of the Roman and Persian empires. And so that's why Christians were in the Persian Empire as well from the earliest days of the church. And the irony is that Christians, while the Roman Empire was antagonistic to Christianity in the first 3 centuries, it wasn't the case in the Persian Empire, in what we now call Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan, that Christians actually were able to thrive there much relatively more peacefully than they could in the Roman Empire, in what we now call Europe. But, you know, that situation changed in the 300s when Christianity was beginning to be presented as like a Roman religion, starting with the alleged conversion of Emperor Constantine. And many Christians in the Roman Empire, they saw themselves as having a Christian emperor, and they saw his economic and military conquests and agenda as the same as God's agenda, and began to, this is where you get the rise of religious nationalism. And later you have Roman theologians like Augustine who are arguing for things like just war and all of that kind of stuff. And so with all of these developments in the 300s starting there, you have Christianity being seen as this Roman religion from within and from without, because the so-called kind of Christianization of the Roman Empire, that led to the persecution of Christians in the Persian Empire, where there were already Christians there for many centuries. But now they were being made to feel that their Persian identity and their Christian religion were somehow at odds with each other. And that is the very beginning of the dynamic that we just talked about at the beginning, where today, even now, 1,700 years later, Christians of color all over the world feel that they have to choose between their cultural identity and their identity as a Christian, and feel that though that those somehow don't go together. Whereas white Christians don't have to ask that question, because Christianity is often presented in such a white Western way. And we talked about the West after the fall of the Western Roman Empire. Well, that's actually when you get the development of the very idea of the West, where you start to have these emerging Western European superpowers that are also becoming Christian at the same time. And so you also have them doing that on the idea, or kind of modeling themselves after Constantine, the so-called Christian emperor. So Christianity in its Western kind of iteration gives birth to European identities and powers that consolidate in the Holy Roman Empire and understand themselves to kind of be in the theological lineage of Constantine. So again, as Western Christianity is developing, it's also giving rise to the very West itself, or to the idea of the West itself in the medieval periods, and also to the birth of the idea of whiteness, or the full fleshing out of the idea of whiteness, which also has its origins in the Greco-Roman world. And so, again, Christianity was already in these other places. But the other kind of next step in the process, after the kind of the so-called Christianization of the West, or what would be known as the West or the Roman Empire, you also had after that the kind of the adoption, or the kind of usurpation of Christian theology. Because as we said, as we already pointed out, there were Christians in the Persian Empire, there were Christians in Africa and Egypt, and then also in Ethiopia, and there were Christians in the Arabian Peninsula and India. But those Christians from the 400s onward were seen by the kind of the dominant Roman, and then later Western or European or white church, were seen, those Asian and African Christians were for the most part seen as heretics. And they were actually persecuted by the Roman church, kind of dominant Roman church. And so that's also what kind of limited the spread of Christianity throughout Asia and Africa. It didn't stop it. It still continued to spread, but it strongly limited it. And also that continued to give birth to and exacerbate a dynamic where, again, the Roman and then emerging Western or white or European world saw itself as kind of the true representatives of Christian doctrine and theology. And then it just kind of continues that way until you get into transatlantic slavery and colonialism. By that time, now that, you know, after both with the limitation of Christian missionaries in Africa and Europe through in Asia through European Christianity, then with the rise of Islam, which is kind of a double whammy that severely limits indigenous African and Middle Eastern and Central Asian Christianity. Now, in the 1400s and onward, you have the introduction, so to speak, of a certain version of Christianity, a colonizing, enslaving version of Christianity, as opposed to what I would say what God was intending, which was kind of the natural indigenous spread of Christianity going in every direction, going west, going east, north, and south as well. Again, it didn't stop it, and those connections still happened. But unfortunately, many people in Africa and Asia, and of course in the Americas, their first introduction to Christianity was, you know, through the vehicle of colonialism and slavery. And I would say it was a perverted version of that.
I'm curious how this makes you feel about the kind of development of orthodoxy and even the creeds that come out of that. I know that there's some that feel like that was really a messed step, that was kind of putting, God in a box, and we should have just been following Jesus. And then also, you know, that can kind of create that orthodoxy versus heresy dynamic that comes into play. So I just, as a Christian, how do you feel about, how does that make you feel about those systems, the creeds, and just kind of that naming orthodoxy?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I would say that, you know, I guess I would make two comments is that, you know, that number one, I think that it's important to point out that the concept of orthodoxy, is not unique to kind of the dominant church that developed in the Roman Empire and that was centered in Constantinople and Rome, but that Christians in Africa and in the Middle East and Asia also strongly believed in orthodoxy. And they also challenged their own religious systems that were indigenous or you know, kind of traditional to their lands and to their context that before they heard of Christianity, before they become Christians. And they also condemned other groups that were heretical. Like you had early Christian groups like the Arians who denied that Jesus was God, and they were condemned and they were argued against by Orthodox Christians, Orthodox in the sense of affirming the full divinity of Jesus in Africa and in India and in the Middle East and in Central Asia and in Europe as well. So, you know, there, I would say there is a such thing as heresy and orthodoxy or right belief and wrong belief. But that's not unique to white people or Western people or European people at all. But I think the second thing I would say is that theology is cultural. God's revelation in Christ and God's revelation in his Holy Scripture and God's, you know, what God does through creation in terms of revealing himself, that's God's universal message of salvation. That's universal truth for all people, all times and all places. So I'm not saying that, you know, truth is plural or relativistic. Not at all. I would say Jesus is the only way, truth and life. Nobody comes to Father except through him. But when we create creeds and when we make theology and we try to use our own words and our own language to kind of crystallize or systematize or just reflect and bounce back from our own perspective, what God has done in creation and in through his Spirit and in Christ Jesus, our theology and our creeds are always going to be contextual. They're always going to be cultural. There's no such thing as some kind of universal theology or some kind of like normalizing theology. The problem, especially in Western white Christian history, is that they have perceived that such a thing is achievable and that through Western languages and words and concepts that humans can give full breath through their words with the divine mysteries of Jesus and then impose those things on other people and mistake their culturally specific, historically rooted articulation of theology for God's divine truth that's communicated directly to humanity and kind of meld those things together. So I think it's also important to remember that there is a such thing as orthodoxy and there is a such thing as the true, pure and universal truth of the gospel message. But again, the way we creedalize or theologize about that is going to be historically rooted and therefore and also culturally rooted and therefore limited. That our particular creed or our particular articulation of faith is not going to be exactly the same as somebody else's. And so we have to understand and give room and respect for all cultures around the world to be able to, according to their words and concepts and cultural worldview, to be able to articulate theology that's committed to the same gospel message, but that's according to their culture. And that's exactly what didn't happen starting in the 400s and going forward, where you had other expressions of Christianity that were growing in other parts of the world. But the Western, to use that word, it comes a little bit later, but at that time, the Roman dominant church saw their articulations of faith as heretical when they actually weren't. And a lot of it was just because of language and miscommunication and different cultures. And so I think that's, you know, how I would say I would feel that's the tension that we have to walk, in terms of how we give witness to orthodoxy of being committed to the universal truth of Jesus and not going to the extreme of universalism or pluralism, but also understanding the cultural relativism and the cultural diversity with which human beings articulate theology, and also having the humility and just the common sense, I would say, to acknowledge that all of our theology is culturally rooted and also culturally limited. And so also not going to the other extreme of colonialism or kind of imposing our particular articulation of orthodoxy on someone else and mixing up our articulation of orthodoxy with God's universal truth.
Would you say early on you spent some time on this in the book, the articulation of the nature of the divinity of Jesus, that seems to be a real splitting point for, and I can't remember the words for who was what, but basically the, you know, two natures, one person, and then versus fully human, fully divine. Is that one of the things that you're talking about? It's a cultural language articulation that gave way to me unnecessary division and confusion?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That was probably the biggest and really the earliest kind of first major rift in the church, before the Protestant Reformation or before the, in Europe, the East European, West European or Orthodox Catholic split in the 11th century. In the fifth century, that was the first major split in the global church. But unlike the other splits that came later, this one was largely along geographical and cultural and also linguistic lines. And, coming out of the fifth century, you had three major kind of brands of Christianity that were all over the world. One of them was the one that was mainly kind of dominant in Europe. There were others of them in other places as well, but it was kind of the main theology in what we now call Europe. And that was the Chalcedonian view. And that name comes from the Council of Chalcedon, which was in 451. And at that time, the dominant church of Rome and Constantinople, which again presented itself as just the church globally, to say nothing of the fact that there was an entire other major empire and imperial church in Persia at the same time. But again, this church was kind of seeing itself as representing all Christians all over the world, even though at this point in the 400s, there was Christianity in Ethiopia, in the massive Persian Empire, in India, and in other places as well. But the Roman Church, speaking for the world, for global Christianity, was trying to make sense, again, to try to use human words to give framing to what is ultimately a divine mystery, which we all give witness to, which we all testify to as believers. But again, I would think we need to have the humility to admit that none of our words or cultures can properly contain the reality that Jesus is Lord, that he is God, and he is a full human being at the same time. Jesus is fully God and he is fully human, and he incarnates and has the full experience of a human being, that except without sin. And that's something that none of us can fully really honestly understand, but it's true and we believe it. But what happened in the 400s was Christians were trying to talk about that and frame it in different ways. So the dominant church at the Roman Empire, and they were following the Pope of Rome at that time, Leo, he said the way to kind of understand that in Greek words and terminology was to say that Jesus is one person, but he has two natures. And so there's even different Greek words to talk about the difference between a person and a nature. And so that was a very kind of new, kind of very Hellenistic or kind of Greco-Roman way of thinking about it. And many Christians in Africa and the Middle East did not like that view. They would say Jesus had one person and he had one nature. And so to many Christians, and now again, in Africa and talking about Egypt, Nubia, Ethiopia, and in the Middle East, talking about like Syria, modern day Jordan, Arabia, or Armenia, many of those Christians, there were some of them that agreed with the dominant position of Rome. One of the most common examples is the Maronite Church of Lebanon, or the Georgian Orthodox. But most people in that part of the world did not agree with that particular articulation of the faith. And to them, it felt like the Roman Church was saying there's two different Jesuses. Now, to be fair, that's not what the Roman Church was saying, but that's how it was received. And a lot of it was because of biblical, literacy. That kind of distinction is not in the Bible. So many of them felt that Leo and the Roman Church were kind of diverging from the Bible. And so they said, no, Jesus is one person and one nature. But the European side, to use that modern language, they saw the kind of the one nature theology that was dominant in Africa and the Middle East. They thought that their view was denying Jesus's full humanity. And they felt that that view was only acknowledging that Jesus was God, but not that he was human. And again, to be fair to the, to use these modern terms, the African and Middle Eastern view, that's not what they were saying. And if we go back and read original primary texts in these languages, we see that they have always and still do today, their heritage communities still fully believe in the full humanity and full divinity of Jesus, that Jesus is fully God and fully human. The difference is whether after the incarnation, his humanity and divinity exist in one united nature, or if they stay in kind of two separate natures. And then also the difference depends on, again, in different languages and cultures, what do you mean when you say person and nature? And everybody has different ideas about what that means. Now, in the Church of the Persian Empire, which is often erroneously called Nestorian, but they're actual name is the Church of the East, they had a completely different view, a third option that was different than both of the dominant European view and the kind of Middle Eastern and African view. But the Church of the East, which would eventually spread all over Asia, that eventually spread early in the 600s, all the way to China and all the way to India, and then even into Southeast Asia, this, which is probably the largest geographical church in the ancient and medieval world, this church had a whole third view, and they would say that Jesus was one person and he had two natures. And then also in the Syriac, in the East Syriac language, they had an extra word that they would talk about that he has two natures, but then each of those natures has a corresponding what they called a kenoma, or kind of a manifestation of that nature. So that view was also seen as heretical. Well, actually, all three of these views all thought that all of them were heretics. And that they were all heretical, right? And I think this is a great example of how, relating this today, how all of us, can have the tendency to think that our ways are the only right ways. All of us can be ethnocentric. All of us can be prejudiced. All of us can, think that our ways of doing things are better than other people's ways of doing things. But, it's kind of like how we talk about difference between racism and prejudice today, that there's a different, it becomes a different thing, though, when one has social and political power to add to their stereotypes, and then they can enact and actuate their stereotypes with actual power and oppression. And again, all of us, anybody could do that. Anybody has the potential. We're all sinful. And in fact, in history, different racial or ethnic groups have done that. But for the last, 1500 years, white or European people have done it at a much more massive level than everybody else has. But everyone can fall subject to this. And so the quote unquote European or Western view that would become dominant for as the West and as Europe was being founded was really built on this theology that was called Chalcedonian, that Jesus is one person and two natures. And it saw these other Christians in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia as heretics, as not real Christians. And they disavowed and wrote off their expressions of Christianity. And interestingly, even in the 14, 15, and 1600s, as Europeans are starting to go out into the world with this kind of continuing idea of being kind of God's representative on earth to bring the gospel and also to bring white culture and to civilize all the barbarians of the world, quote unquote, as they were doing that in the Americas and in other parts of Africa and Asia, they also came upon some of these Christians that had long ancient legacy of Christianity, and that were even older than the European versions, especially in Northern and Western Europe. And yet they still enacted colonialism and tried to convert these people away from their ancestral ancient church traditions to what they saw as true Christianity.
So if I can go back to those three views on Jesus, correct me if I'm wrong, but what you're advocating for is a kind of cultural humility where we can say, okay, it looks like we're all trying to articulate the same thing in our own context and be okay with that. not try to, one, not label these other articulations as heretical, call these people full brothers and sisters in Christ and allow for that flourishing within its own context. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I would just say, again, within the boundaries of the gospel message, and that's where things get tricky, right? Because I would say, for example, that if you have somebody like Arius who's saying Jesus is not God or Jesus is less than God, he was created by God, well, then that's a betrayal of the gospel message, because how can Jesus bear the full weight of sin and yet resurrect if he's not fully God, if he's not divine? And so, and that's why I would say the idea of orthodoxy is not a Western concept, or it didn't emerge with colonists, but there is an idea such as orthodoxy we have to hold to. But within the boundaries of orthodoxy, within the boundaries of the gospel message, yes, that there's room to agree to disagree on, certain things. There's certain things I would say that, we can disagree about anything, but there's a certain point where it's like, well, then this is now outside of the boundaries of what makes the body of Christ and what gives, kind of what is life-saving faith. That's now outside the boundaries of that. But inside of that, there has to be humility to say, we agree to disagree. For example, we can all be saved. We can all be believers. We can all believe in the gospel. And somebody over here can baptize babies, and people over here only baptize, people who have professed faith. And, I would say, again, we can agree to disagree on that, as long as we're all committed to the gospel. And I'd say, yes, that in this case of this these Christological agreements where they were saying, well, we all believe Jesus is the way, truth, and life. We all believe in the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. We all believe Jesus is fully God and fully human. But these folks are saying he's one person. He's one hypostasis and two physis. These people over here are saying he's one person and one physis. And then these people over here are saying he's one parsopa and he's two kiane. And then they have their two kanome. But I'm like, okay, you all believe Jesus is fully God, fully human. Okay, you're all Christians and just agree to disagree. And actually, there have been like modern in the kind of more recent decades, there have been kind of statements of unity and unity of faith that have been issued by these communities today that have said the same thing I'm saying, basically paraphrasing, but basically saying, hey, that argument that we had 1500 years ago and that has still persisted in dividing us as churches today, you know, we didn't really need to divide over that. We're all Christians and we just didn't understand each other's wording.
Yeah. That's so good and so helpful too. I mean, I feel like there are ways in which there are glimmers of where it's been done right. You know, like I've heard of, you know, if there are people groups who don't understand the human heart as being the center of our being and emotions, well then, you know, you could talk about whatever that is, your pancreas or whatever, you know? Or if there's a people group and they don't have sheep, and you know, want to explain that, you know, Jesus was the goat of God or whatever, you know, the dog, the cat or whatever, because you have that in your culture, right? And it seems like the whole story of the gospel is God contextualizing himself to human beings, right?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, a great example of that is even in the gospels, you know, Matthew is speaking to the Hebrews, so he calls Jesus the Son of Man. But then John is writing to the Gentiles, and so he calls Jesus the Logos. And again, you know, the idea of like a divine word that or Logos, that doesn't make sense to, you know, Hebrews. And on the flip side, to Gentiles, Son of Man wouldn't make any sense. And so you're exactly right that the gospel is always translating or incarnating or taking up residence within every language, every culture, every tribe and nation, and you know, communicating the gospel in a way that those people can understand. That's right.
I loved your last chapter, your conclusion. I feel like that could have been its own book. You locate two things that are kind of the key that are very important. And one is contextualized theology, which is kind of what we've been talking about. And the other is, and I don't even know if I'm going to say this word right, autochthonous leadership. Is that how you say that?
Mm-hmm.
Essentially indigenous leadership, right?
Yeah, I use the word autochthonous just to kind of out of respect for my indigenous, you know, brothers and sisters who are like indigenous people.
No, totally. That was a fun word to learn anyway, so I like it. A contextualized theology, like I think after what we've been talking about, people kind of understand that. And then indigenous leadership, why, like, I think we kind of intuitively understand why that's important, but speak to that for a second.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, you know, great question. And I would say, you know, that, I think that, you know, like Laman Sané talks about, you know, when he talks about translation and that the gospel is always translating and taking on the language, he also talks about, you know, what we mentioned earlier, kind of about the theology and how it's our human response, or he calls it the cultural feedback, that a particular culture or tribe hears the gospel, but then they give their feedback and they bounce back, kind of reflect back, and all of us are made in the image of God. Therefore, all of our cultures have God's presence in them. But yet because of sin, all of our cultures have gotten off track as well. But Jesus comes in and doesn't reject or negate the culture, but rather he sanctifies, purifies, and completes the culture. And so that it's in that feedback, Laman Sané says that's the way we really know when the gospel is really taking root in a particular culture and context, when they can give that feedback according in their own language, in their own tongue and concepts, but reflecting back that same gospel message that the Holy Spirit communicates to all of us. And I would say that has to be done, as you mentioned, in contextualized ways, but also it has to be done with local leaders, with, you know, autochthonous leaders, with people who are from that particular community, rather than people who are foreign to it kind of always being in charge. Because I would say that when it's primarily foreign leaders who are running or leading or guiding a church movement within a particular culture, then that's number one, that's ineffective. And that's not playing the long game of making sure that the gospel message takes long lasting and firm root in a particular people. But also I would say, and to say it even more strongly, I would say that that is actually a direct assault on the belief that these people are made in the image of God. If they are made in the image of God and they hear from God just as strongly as I do, then who's to say that I have to wait until they have gotten a certain level that I have approved of, until I will allow them to kind of guide their own church and worship proceedings. And especially when they are much more equipped than I am of leading and communicating and translating the message in their own culture and in their own tongue than somebody who's not from that context or that background. And we see that overseas, and we also see it with ethnic minority communities in states where there's often white leadership that is not empowering Black, brown, and yellow and red leadership to run their own churches and organizations. And I would say that is a practical living out of habitual way of denying the image of God in all of these people, and also, again, not allowing the gospel to take deep root among, you know, the people who, again, are much more suited to communicate the message in their own particular cultural idiom.
Well, you bring out the fact in the book that one of the missional models has been for the missionary to go start a church, and when it gets, you know, to a certain point, hand it off to the indigenous leaders. And you bring up that a much more effective way is to, from the beginning, allow the indigenous believers to start their own churches and be a support when we're called in to be a support, when we're invited in by that people group.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I would say, I mean, now we live in the day now where, again, it's not the first century anymore, where, you know, there's about, what, 197 countries or something like that. And I would say that there are probably churches, Christian churches, with indigenous leaders or autochthonous leaders in every one of those countries. And so I think that we really need to start shifting our perception of missions to, really shifting it away from thinking, oh, I need to go to this place. And it's usually person with privilege and wealth going into a place with not as much of that. And I'm needed to be in that place, and start shifting to think, how can we partner with and empower leaders who are from that place, who are much more well-suited and equipped to reach and build a church movement and a revival movement in that context? How can I support what they're doing rather than me needing to be the one at the front or at the helm of it, which is still in the 21st century, the majority of where dollars and resources and emphasis goes on is the foreigner who's leading a particular movement in these contexts. And I think we really need to shift and pivot into empowering leaders who are indigenous, who are autochthonous to that cultural context, and supporting what they're doing. But being, having the humility, even though there's not as much glory or as much, it might not be as sexy or fun or adventurous or whatever. But that's, again, playing the long game of actually some missiology with history, and showing how historically, when you've had Christian context in places where they may have even been there for centuries, that it can change, that things can change. And I argue throughout the book and provide evidence to show that Christian communities and context, when there isn't a large degree of contextualization and a large support of autochthonous leadership, then there can sometimes be a centuries-long presence of the gospel in a place, and it can die out. And on the flip side, when it is deeply contextualized and when there are autochthonous leaders at the helm of a church, then that particular church, and I point out examples, can weather religious persecution, poverty, war, colonialism, and still survive to this day, to the present day, and survive for centuries if, again, it is allowed and given room to live and breathe in its own language and its own ethos.
Well, you mentioned that, and I don't remember your words exactly, but the reason the gospel hasn't been allowed to flourish outwardly is for cultural reasons, not theological reasons.
Yeah, I would say that that's the case with what I would say is the largest obstacle to the gospel in the world. I mean, to be sure, there are a lot of people who have theological and philosophical and scientific and historical objections to the Christian faith. But I would argue that a lot of those are actually in the like white or Euro kind of Euro descended world. And so that's why for people who are in that white dominant world, it's probably hard for them to track with this particular crisis, really, because again, nobody who's white, whether you're in Europe or North America or Australia, whatever, nobody who's white and not a Christian, none of them are going to say, well, I don't want to be a Christian because that's antithetical to my white identity. That's, you know, being a Christianity is somehow kind of foreign to my German or white American or Canadian or Australian or French identity. That's not going to happen because, as I already pointed out earlier, in fact, many Western nations, embrace Christianity very early in their ethnogenesis. And so Christianity is very much at the heart of European and Western identity. So a lot of the post-Christian or de-Christian or whatever dynamics we see in that evangelism and apologetics and missions looks like in the white world is usually people rejecting the gospel for scientific or philosophical or, you know, a political or ethical reasons, but it's not for issues of cultural identity. But when you go outside of the white world into the rest of the world, which is the majority of the world, when you go into Asian or African or indigenous or Middle Eastern or South Pacific context, and you're dealing with non-Christians, I'm talking about non-white non-Christians, the number one reason by far, with little competition, the number one reason why non-white non-Christians do not want to be a Christian is because of cultural identity reasons. It's because they see Christianity as a Western white American thing that is fundamentally antithetical to who they are as Japanese, as, you know, Yoruba, as Incan, as, you know, whatever culture they're coming from. If they're not white and if they're not a Christian, then the number one reason is for that reason. And that's, you know, and that's precisely why it's so important to teach on and help people understand that Christianity is not a Western religion. It never has been. And any examples we've seen throughout the last 1700 years where Christianity is trying to present itself as it's some kind of like white dominant thing that is really just kind of a ploy of building Western hegemony in the world, that is, as Frederick Douglass would say, that's not the peace loving religion of Christ, but that is the evil slave driving lynching religion of this particular land. And the two have nothing to do with each other.
Mm, that is so helpful, Vince. Thank you. I wonder if you could help me out with one thing. In the last chapter, you had this really interesting section. These two missiologists, Andrew Walls and I'm going to try to say this right,
Lamansane.
Lamansane, thank you. Can you explain what their missiological models were and then explain the pushback that Willie James Jennings has? Because I think that his voice kind of looms large these days for good reasons. Where do they digress? And then where do you land on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that I think that, you know, Dr. Jennings has done some great work, around just trying to like explore the kind of the colonial mind in the 16th and 17th and, you know, following centuries in his work, Christian Imagination, where he engages with Walls and Sane indirectly and kind of pushes back on them and, kind of alleging that they're engaged in some kind of like, you know, supersessionism with their strong emphasis on how the gospel translates into other cultural contexts. And I think his perception or his feeling is that can lead to a kind of a theological historical supersessionism where Christianity is too divorced. In my understanding of Jennings' pushback, that Christianity becomes too divorced from its Jewish Hebraic roots. And as he, to use his words, he says that, you know, the Gentiles, so to speak, or the nations are they have to go through Israel, and that the theological home of Christianity geographically and culturally is Israel. And we have to understand, how the gospel and how Jesus himself incarnates in a Jewish Hebraic context. And I think that that's a great point. And I think that in other contexts or in certain places, that's a well-received point where there are examples of so-called Christian anti-Semitism. And I say so-called not on the anti-Semitism part, but on the Christian part, because those two have nothing to do with each other. And where there may be we know in the early church and up until today, there's always been this articulation of Christian doctrine or orthodoxy that is antagonistic to the Jewish religion and people. And so I think where that is a, because it's a balance, right? It's a delicate balance. I mean, Jesus was a Jew and the earliest Christians were Hebrews, and the gospel message and the God's plan of salvation from Genesis to Revelation is a story of God's salvation of the humanity through the Jews, through the Hebrews. And so his point's well taken to a degree. But I also think that in other contexts, it can be not as necessary to really highlight that, where I would say anti-Semitism isn't really the main obstacle that one is dealing with in that context, but it's more so one's like perception of cultural alienation from the gospel. And so I would say that his point might be well taken in certain contexts, but in the context, for example, where I do ministry to speak as a pastor and and an evangelist in like urban African-American context where there's lots of marginalization and oppression, and even a certain version of Christianity, I would say a perversion of Christianity, is weaponized in order to add to the oppression that urban African-Americans, low-income African-Americans experience, even in 2022, that, you know, anti-Semitism isn't really the main issue to worry about. Or and so in that space, in that context, it's not as important to emphasize the Jewish identity of Jesus and the disciples, while not ignoring or downplaying that. The main thing to emphasize in that space, or for example, in indigenous communities or in other places where people have been oppressed by Western Christianity, I think the main thing to emphasize is exactly what Walls and Sane point out, which is the cultural incarnation that the gospel takes, that the message to say that indigenous or African descended or other cultures that have been historically made to feel that they are somehow antithetical to Christianity, that they actually have a home in Christianity, that they actually have a home, they're not only acceptable, but they come to their fullest sense of identity in Christ Jesus. And I think that's really the thing that Walls and Sane emphasize with their with the translation kind of paradigm that Sane he really gives. And so I would disagree with the critique that that's supersessionistic. I just think that it's the message of freedom and liberation that many marginalized people of color around the world really need to hear.
It seems like you're kind of echoing Paul when he's saying we don't need to make it hard on our Gentile brothers and sisters to come to Christ. And applying that to these other cultures.
That's right. And you're exactly right. And yet that same Paul in Acts 21, he partnered with James to say, now that also his message to the Gentiles doesn't negate his own love for his own people, as he made clear in Romans 10. But then also in Acts 21, it doesn't even negate his participation in the temple rituals. And also, and James even says, now, you know, we know that you're not saying a Jewish Christian is no longer a Jew. That's just your emphasis to the Gentiles is on their inclusivity and their adoption and the articulation. So you're exactly right.
That's so good. Vince, it's been so good to talk with you. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, thank you. Anytime.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have, and I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right. Thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. But